Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Many in the local and national journalistic communities are mourning the recent death of journalist, columnist George Curry. Curry was a force in journalism, a champion of civil rights and social justice. It really started in St. Louis, but his reputation ultimately extended far beyond our town. He reported for the Post-Dispatch, the Chicago Tribune, Emerge magazine, and was active in the National Newspaper Publishers Association, an association of 200 black newspapers. We're remembering George Curry in this segment with Linda Lockhart, outreach specialist for St. Louis Public Radio. Chris King is editorial director at the St. Louis American, and Alvin Reed is a freelance journalist and Donnybrook panelist on the Nine Network of Public Media. Thanks all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
I know the two of you had a personal relationship with George Curry, so we'll start with you, and Linda, I'll begin with you at that. Tell us very briefly what your association with him was.
Well, I've known George since I first came into this business when I was a young reporter at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. When I graduated from Mizzou and I got to the Post-Dispatch in 1974... George was already there, and he was a force of nature. And together with Gerald Boyd and a group of other fine people, a couple years later, we established the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists. We also established a workshop for high school students that's become a model for other black journalist organizations around the country. And has we've produced probably more than 1,000 young people in these last 40 years of people that are on the Gerald Boyd, George Curry model of teaching young people journalism.
Wow, that's quite a record and quite a legacy.
We think so.
Alvin, let me turn to you. Yours was a somewhat different relationship.
Well, I was one of those kids in January of 1977. I was at Kirkwood High School, and I was a junior. And, you know, I had decided in eighth grade I wanted to work at a newspaper, and I worked for the high school newspaper. And this program had been started by the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists, a minority journalism workshop, and I got a application from somewhere, and I filled it out, was there that first Saturday, knew this is what I wanted to do, met professional journalists for the first time. And George Curry had absolutely no mercy on me or anybody else who was in that workshop. And I learned so much, and I learned about being a professional, and I learned about rolling with the punches, and I learned that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. But the real lesson I learned was that George, he just was just driven to make black journalists and good ones. He just would not accept average. He told us you had to be better, you had to work harder. That stuck with me all through college and professional career. And he didn't care if you went to Soldan, Beaumont, Kirkwood, Ledoux. He was the same on everyone. And at first, I kind of thought, like, man, you're kind of hard on the city kids, man. You know, but he didn't want to hear it. And so I think, as Linda said, thousands of journalists have been made through that program. He helped make thousands of journalists. I helped create in Lansing when I was at Lansing State Journal. Up at Michigan State, we did the program. We actually had one that not started in Washington, D.C. when I was at USA Today Baseball Weekly. It began on the Howard campus. This has been emulated across the United States of America, still goes on, and it creates young, I will say that you can't say black, minority, urban journalism anymore. It has to be some kind of other workshop, but it's still creating minority journalists, and it goes back to George and Gerald Boyd right here in St. Louis.
And Chris King, let me turn to you. I gather you did not know him personally, but you wrote with some passion about him in the American.
Yeah, when I joined the St. Louis American 12 years ago, George was the dean of black journalists and was until he passed. He was the gold standard. He was the editor-in-chief of NNPA, the National Newspaper Publisher Association, the Black Press Trade Association, and just the most reliable source of national news of interest to the black community. I've read him every week since I got my job, and truly, I wrote the editorial with Dr. Suggs saying, our publisher, Donald M. Suggs, saying it will be harder to do this job. I mean, very selfishly, my job gets harder instantly without George Curry.
Why will it be harder?
He just has the best news judgment of anybody I know looking at the America from the eyes of an African-American. Just on spot, on point, cogent. I'll take a moment, if I may, and read the last piece of George we'll publish in our newspaper, if we have a moment for that.
If it's not much more than
just
a moment.
A few paragraphs?
Yeah.
Reverend Edwin C. Sanders II sized up his audience at the 21st International AIDS Conference here in Durban, South Africa, and uttered instructions one wouldn't normally expect to hear from a minister. Turn to your neighbor and say, sex, he said, catching delegates to the conference off guard. but after a couple of seconds of nervous hesitation, they complied. And it becomes the problem of talking about sex in the church, which becomes a problem of talking about HIV mm-hmm. in the church. There's not a better lead to that story, and there's not a more important story. And we have it in our paper because George went to Durbin.
And well, you can't miss with sex, that's for sure. It's a good way to draw some attention. Mm-hmm. Linda, let me come back to you. You referred to him as a force of nature. Be a little more specific about that.
Well, in fact, as one of our former students, Marcia Davis, who works for the Washington Post now, said in a tweet earlier this week, she said, he was a comet flying across the sky. He was always in motion, always thinking, always trying to, as Alvin said, drive himself and everybody else to be better. There was a term in the early days of the workshop that when we were still editing, kids were writing these stories, this is 40 years ago, folks, with typewriters and...
Electrics.
We were editing on by hand with red ink pens. And he would make the copy bleed. He would have so many corrections in a young reporter's work that they thought was this great piece they had turned in. And after you got done editing it, it was all red. He made students cry. He made the boys cry as much as the girls cry, but they were better for it. The one thing that I think really sticks out of my mind about George, too, was he told the young people early on in this age of trying to have diverse people in the newsrooms that there is no such thing as objectivity. Journalists try and say, I'm objective about this story. And he said, no, we all bring something to the table about our past life, our past experience, the life we're living now. And we want to be fair. We want to be balanced. We want to tell all sides of a story. But we cannot separate our personal selves from the things we're covering, whether it's school desegregation or it's housing or jobs or law enforcement. We all have a different perspective, and none of us can leave that on the table. So I think that was an important lesson to learn. It's be fair, but don't pretend to be objective because we all do care.
And a Georgism that he told us was one, he said, like, I don't want to hear that stuff about you're a journalist who's black. You're a black journalist. So just never forget that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned the comment. I saw it twice because I was honored that he called me when Emerge was going to come to Washington, D.C. from New York. And I'm sitting there. Basically, it really was an afternoon where I was sitting there doing nothing. The publication had just come out. And I was just sitting there, whatever, and the phone rang. You know, so, like, Alvin Reed, and it's George. He said, hey, I got an offer you can't refuse. And I'm thinking, like, well, and my first thought was, I'm not moving to New York. Now, I don't know what he's going to say, but I actually was thinking that. And he said, explain that BET had bought Emerge and a couple other magazines. They were moving to the Washington, D.C. area. He wanted me to be senior editor of Emerge magazine. I was so honored. I took the job. And once again, it was the same George. He was driven. And like, when we would come up with ideas, there was no, you can't do that. We can't afford that. Do it. Do it. This is us. This is you. And he had three young associate editors that were in their 20s. And once again, he found them. They were there. And he told them, hey, you work for the best black news magazine in America. I don't want to hear that you're 25 or 26. All I want to do is put out an award-winning publication, and which is what we did.
It ultimately failed, however.
Billionaire Bob Johnson at BET took care of that.
Well, it didn't fail under George's leadership. I think new owners came in and changed the direction of it. George wanted to be a hard-hitting news organization and not a People-like magazine or an Ebony-like magazine. He wanted to be something different.
I only brought that up because, Linda, you indicated off-air that he was working at the end on trying to reestablish it.
Exactly. In the last year or so, he was bringing back Emerge Online and was doing a major fundraising effort for it. And Emerge Online is out and up right now, not in the complete format that he was hoping, but as a news aggregator, bringing together stories that people should read with a little bit of commentary. So I think that's one of the things that was hit me hard when I realized that he's been working so hard to get Emerge back up and running, and then to lose him like this was very difficult.
And he had been in ill health for a period of time.
For more than a year. He had a minor heart attack about a year ago, and then he had pneumonia earlier this year. And he took the heart attack last year as a warning, and even told his friends and associates and loved ones, you know, listen to the warning signs. And if anything, you know, we all need to remember that if you have anything that's even remotely health related, follow it up. And so it's very sad for the way I think this all happened.
Chris, can you tell an interesting story about his moonlighting for your newspaper while he was with the Post-Dispatch?
It was before my time at the American or Alvin's time at the American, but in 1982, while employed at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and without telling his bosses he was doing this, he crossed town after work, spent 4 hours a day at the American helping Donald M. Suggs format the newspaper. Suggs bought the paper from some other interests and had, I think it's fair to say, a more serious interest in serious journalism.
Well, from the Sweets family, let's just say that, you know, from the Nathan Sweets family and parents of Fred Sweets and Ellen Sweets.
Who I love dearly, very much so, and who had a great legacy in journalism in their own right. But Suggs, I believe it's fair to say, wanted to change the paper. And George was important, and Robert Joyner, who was here also.
Another wonderful Post-Dispatch reporter.
Post-Dispatch, but you can say
and St. Louis Public Radio reporter at the end, too.
Yeah, they were extremely important in a short period of time. I mean, I think George was only at The American about 4 months. But in that time, he formatted the paper substantially, the one that that I inherited 12 years ago and have done almost nothing to change because it's such a logically organized newspaper.
What is the importance of black newspapers in our community and our country?
Well, I think everyone could speak to that.
Well, we'll have them do it that, but what do you think?
Obviously, most decision makers and most media organizations are not black. I work for one person who owns one newspaper and he's an African American, and nothing gets in that paper that offends him or upsets him or violates his sense of what's proper to speak to our community about. And you need a decision maker at the top or very near the top, in my opinion, especially in an area like St. Louis, which has so many African Americans. So I think any news organization is in peril that doesn't have that equity and diversity near the top. So if it's black owned, it's at the very top. So, I mean, anything in our paper that slips past our publisher that gets into print that he doesn't like, it's a bad time talking to him about that.
You know, and thinking of Donald Suggs, I don't think I've ever heard him raise his voice, but I can imagine he can be formidable when he wants it to be.
He has raised his voice.
I have. What George did with The American, and like I say, I was just beginning, you know, my career professionally. And it was later when he was, you know, I was at The American, I'd see him in NPA conferences and whatnot. And he said, like, I actually, you know, when Dr. Suggs bought the paper, I actually didn't. This is the first time I'd ever heard that story. I didn't know it. But it was so believable because the newspaper, like, say, when I got there, the newspaper was a newspaper. Mm-hmm. And what I also found out, and I'm sure Chris did as well, and Linda, you know this too, when you compare The American to other black news, to most black newspapers owned in the United States of America, it's a night and day difference. It's not that I was smart. It's not that, you know, Dot was a genius anyway. Somebody formulated that said, like, hey, if you're going to do it, be a real newspaper. And that decision still hasn't been made by a lot of black newspapers. It was made here in 1982, and George helped. Dr. Suggs make that
we
decision.
Should point out that The American routinely is called one of the best black newspapers in the country.
Well, last 5 years, yeah. Won the award for general excellence, and many, many times before that under Alvin's tenure, many,
sure.
Many times. And that was another thing was George was at NNPA, the Black Press Trade Association, for many years, and he would call Suggs personally. And I believe that was partly his taking some pride, because really,
sure.
Truly, he formatted the newspaper that substantially we still edit today.
And if I could just follow briefly on what Chris said before about when you asked on why the black press, you know, and
yeah.
Absolutely, because the majority of mainstream papers are headed by white people, white males in most cases. And so, again, we are a diverse country with diverse stories. There's a Bosnian newspaper, there are Latino newspapers. Even though we're still trying to cover all sides of the story, it's still through the lens and the prism of the people we represent. And so the black press, I think, takes that very seriously, that we're going to tell the stories of black people in their own voice and not as filtered through somebody else's eyes.
And this was something he obviously understood and
absolutely.
Understood it long since.
Exactly.
We have a caller here I'd like to bring into the conversation who has a question, and I think one that I was going to ask, but let's have Robin ask it. Robin, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Robin Boyce, and I'm a former student of George Curry's, probably one of the first ones he had in the first workshop we had out there at St. Louis Community College many, many years ago. And his mission, and along with the black journalists in the St. Louis area who pulled the organization together, was to make sure that we got more black journalists into newsrooms. Mm-hmm. The question would be, especially to a newspaper like the St. Louis American and to an organization like St. Louis Public Radio, has that changed? Do we have more people of color in the newsroom as news editors, as news managers? As I moved back to the St. Louis area, left here for a little while, and George was very happy that I did that, that it hasn't changed here at all. It's been very difficult moving back here to a community that still does not accept African Americans in their newsrooms and is not hiring them at all. So that's one of my questions that I have there. And just want to say about George, he was an awesome, awesome teacher. He always was there for you whenever you had a question about something. Whenever I started a new project, he was always there to help me get through it. He stayed on me about pulling together the 40th anniversary that the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists will be holding in December. I hope you talk more about that, Linda, and some of the things that we're going to be doing there. And I just have to say, George was the best. He was the best of the best, and he will be missed by many of us who were under his tutelage for many, many years. And I want to thank you very much for allowing me to come on the air to talk about
Robin,
that.
Robin, thank you for being with us. Well, let's start with you, Chris, with regard to newsroom participation.
I recently conducted a journalism fellowship opening weekend for the Association of Healthcare Journalists. And it was a diverse group, and I asked them all whose boss is a black man, a white woman. I got in trouble for doing binaries of black and white because it was much more diverse. But everyone in this room, and it was a large group of mid-career journalists, they'd all had, every one of them had a black boss and a woman boss. That made me feel good. I do believe that St. Louis is a bit behind on that. I mean, I can speak for our newsroom. It's very diverse. It's majority black. I'm a white person. Report to a black man who's very much my boss, but I am the managing editor as a white man. We have a Hispanic reporter. Every other reporter is African-American. But it's we've always had a diverse newsroom. We just did a big diversity story on the Post that Dick Weiss, a former Post staffer, reported. And he pointed out the lack of African-American leadership at the Post historically. They've never had a black editor. And that's, I think, an issue the Post, I hope, rectifies in my lifetime.
Yeah. Alvin, what are you saying?
Well, since my days of leaving, like daily journalism, I can say that when I was at Gannett, one of the things they did, And it was not emulated by other newspaper organizations, was they basically told the editor of the newspaper, part of your bonus is based upon does your newsroom represent the community that you live in. So thus, oddly, in a place in Danville, Illinois, which had 14% African Americans, or Lansing was about the same, there were black reporters, and I became a business editor at Lansing. And it wasn't affirmative action. It was a man who said, like, you know what, I want that whatever few thousand dollars it is, so I'm going to make it happen. I think those kinds of things have not gone on throughout America. I also think, and I'm not blaming anybody, you know, a minority by anybody, but I was more than prepared to go someplace that I'd never been before and work. And I wish more black kids would be ready to say, if you want to do the job, go to where the job is. And that has dropped. But that's true with not just black kids. That's true with white kids, too. That's sure. Just true with kids. Absolutely. Kids today.
What the devil's wrong with these kids?
Yeah, exactly.
Linda, go ahead.
Sure. I'd like to say, I guess, you know, I love Robin and very much glad she called in. I don't think it's fair to say the Post-Dispatch has not hired any black reporters. Their numbers, I think, are more diverse across the newsroom and perhaps fewer than they were back in the 70s or 80s. But you have Deborah Bass, who's the fashion editor, and Kevin Johnson, who's entertainment writer. Ron Wade is the outstanding night news editor. And they have a few young people like Karan Adu and others who have come into the staff. But it's not hasn't grown, in certainly in the ranks of management, the way we had certainly hoped, I think, 30, 40 years ago. I'm very proud and humbled to say here at Public Radio, I think about a third of our news staff is not white, and people of color, African Americans, Latinos, Asian people in our newsroom. And we're not a very big newsroom, but still, if you say 30%, if other people replicated that, it'd be a whole different way of telling stories.
True. And I would just say the only problem I really have with the Post-Dispatch, I don't think you can have an editorial board that does not have a black person on it in this day and age, because you're basically editorializing a lot of times about black people and you have no black voice. And that's just, I can't fathom.
And that's
that.
Very true. I think I wrote editorials for a few years at the Post-Dispatch, as did Bob Joyner. And again, as so many parts of the Post-Dispatch's newsroom have been reduced in numbers, they only have about two or three people writing editorials back, you know, when others were on there. And so it's very difficult to see diversity continue and grow the way it should.
Our time is beginning to wind down. Chris, I did want to ask you for a very quick story. You mentioned in your editorial that Hillary Clinton sent her condolences. I think you wrote it, our next president, Hillary Clinton. He's maybe prescient, I don't know, but I wanted to point that out, that his breadth and reach was very, very extensive.
And she said, revealed the narrow understanding of people, including myself. Hillary Clinton said that she was more narrow before she read George Curry than after. Mm-hmm. I could say the same.
I'll go around the table, and I'll start with you, as long as we're right there. What do you see as his national impact? We've talked about the local impact.
is just such a clear voice of conscience. He quoted liberally from sources, made cogent arguments, urged change in his reader. Any writer who reads that style of writing is compelled to follow it because it's the most effective way to communicate.
Elvin?
I think nationally what he got across was it's old school, it's tough, but it's journalism. And I think, I'm sure George looked at how it was done now and kind of cringed in that just people have lost track of it's interviewing, it's writing, it's reporting, and it's doing the job. And that's what he was about. It was about doing the job. No excuses. Do the job.
Linda?
And as Chris said, you know, with others, Hillary Clinton himself, other white people who read him, I think America, not just black America, America is better for having people like George Curry to help tell stories. We will be doing more to celebrate him, as Robin mentioned, in the 40th anniversary celebration on December 3rd of the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists. And I hope we can talk about that more a little closer to that date. So thank you.
I'm sure we will do that. I wish I could take a call from Dick, who is going to tell us why he hired Alvin, but we'll have to save that for another time. We're out of time.
Well, thanks, Don.
Thank you all for being with us. Linda Lockhart and Alvin Reed and Chris King, great to see you all. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. News was made this week when Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce appeared on our Legal Roundtable program. Among the discussion points, the Missouri Public Defender's Office. Its director, Michael Barrett, has been outspoken in his complaints that the system is underfunded, understaffed, and hard-pressed to provide adequate defense for clients. He raised eyebrows when, blaming Governor Nixon for budget shortcomings, he claims that the law allows him to appoint any lawyer to accept an indigent client when the need arose. He then appointed Governor Nixon to a criminal case. A Cole County judge now says Barrett does not have that right. That only courts do. Nonetheless, Barrett is still rejecting Joyce's claims the public defenders are crying wolf and could do a lot more to help their own cause. I put that to Barrett in an interview on Wednesday before the most recent court ruling.
Yeah, well, her reaction stemmed around the comments that, you know, our lack of resources and our overburdened caseload isn't what it's, you know, we say it is. And, you know, I find that troubling. I've long felt that prosecutors are in the best position to determine whether they have enough resources to do their job. And I was always hoping that, you know, prosecutors felt the same way about us. But when she weighed in and said what she said, I think, you know, at best, it's untruthful. And at most, it's defamatory.
Yeah. She said, and I'm quoting here, she does not see the public defender advocacy lacking in any way, that her colleagues throughout the state feel the same way. The PD is no less resourced than the prosecutor's
office.
Well,
that's just not true. And I would encourage media outlets to sunshine both my office and her office for all of our resources and salary information. And we're certainly willing to provide that information. We only get money from the state, and I think she gets money from the state, the city, as well as the federal government. But we're always happy to compare that. And then the media can do a breakdown of who's more resourced.
Give me a sense of the underfunding aspect and the overworked aspect of your department.
Well, sure. We've been saying for years that we had, you know, too many cases, not enough lawyers. But people were skeptical, and rightfully so. And so for that reason, the American Bar Association asked a nationally renowned accounting firm, Reuben Brown, to conduct a study. And it's then that we became the first system in the country to require our attorneys to time log precisely how they spend their time in 10-minute increments. After the study was conducted, the Reuben Brown, the accounting firm, reached the conclusion that we needed 250-plus additional lawyers in order to provide constitutionally competent representation. That on top of the Department of Justice's report last year that said there's not enough lawyers in the system to provide constitutionally competent representation, as well as the data from that's collected by several national organizations that cite that we're the second to last in the country in public defender funding. It's not a question of perspective. It's just fact.
Yeah, and this is what prompted you to suggest that Governor Nixon be given a case to really kind of dramatize, I guess, this
Well,
situation.
I don't know how I don't use every available tool at my disposal to deal with this this caseload crisis. And I had a statute staring me in the face that said I had the ability to appoint private lawyers. And as I pointed out in my letter, I don't think it's fair to shift the burden away from the state and onto private lawyers to handle these cases. And I think if I'm going to use that, I should start with the person that caused this problem.
You got some publicity in the New York Times. New York Times editorial called him stingy as a result of what you had written.
Well, I'm not going to assign adjectives to his behavior, sure. But I will say that this is a constitutional right to counsel, and it's an obligation of state government to provide it.
I'd like to play something for you now that Jennifer Joyce said on this program the other day with regard to legislation which would help overburdened lawyers. Listen to this, and then you can respond to it.
Sure.
There is a statutory process whereby, and it was passed by the legislature, the General Assembly, 3 years ago with the consent of the public defenders, where they can actually seek to get a declaration that any particular circuit is overburdened, and then they can step forward from there getting private lawyers. They have not done this.
So the opportunity is there, according to Ms. Joyce, for you to do that, but you've not done it.
Well, we've done it for quite a while, and before this provision existed, we had our own rule that allowed for it before the statute was enacted. Now, what overruled that rule that we came up with, that was affirmed by the state Supreme Court, was a statute that was advanced, the very one she's referring to, by prosecutors, which made the system that we already had in place to turn away cases much more onerous, so that any overburdened attorney would have to go through all manner of hill and vale to put on evidence and have a hearing in order to turn away those cases. I'm of the opinion that the attorneys, whether you're a public defender or a big-time lawyer at a major law firm, don't have to use a provision created by legislature. It's a requirement of the rules of professional responsibility when you can no longer take additional cases to simply tell the judge, I can't confidently represent this individual.
So what is going on here? We have the things that she is saying. The county prosecutor, Bob McCullough, has said the same thing in the past. Is this simply the adversarial relationship that exists naturally between prosecutor and defender?
Well, I think that's part of it. When you have the upper hand, you want to keep the upper hand, and that's part of the adversarial process of it. But I think it also shows a disdain for our system of justice. You know, those balanced scales that represent our system of justice show that it only works when they're balanced. And when one side is so well-resourced and the other side is not, and I'll give you just one fact. You know, we did 74,000 cases last year, and it's a 12% increase over this year, 82,000 cases. We resolved everything from misdemeanors to non-capital level murder cases with overhead, all costs, for $355 per case. Now, most of your listeners have hired an attorney at some point, and they know they can't hire an attorney for anything, much less to protect against the loss of liberty, for $355. Yeah. If she's suggesting, as she did in her interview, that there's more efficiencies to be gained, you know, I'd like to find out where they might be.
Well, she has said, and I think I mentioned this to you earlier, she does not see any problem, any lacking in any way with the public defender's office. And what she actually says is suggesting very strongly that it's mismanaged. Let's listen to what she had to say.
I think that probably the management of the public defender's office should be where we focus and see if there's ways to streamline and there's some economies there, because I'm not going to get into a litany here, but I see a lot of ways that they act inconsistently with their claims of impoverishment. And I'm sure that they would say the same for me, but I think we need to start, you know, not step away from doing the stunts and the flashy stuff and really take a look at what efficiencies are there? What can we do to help the public defenders feel like they have sufficient resources?
The stunt is a reference to your request that the governor become a public defender.
I got that. And, you know, I'm really taken aback by her suggestion that we don't take advantage of every efficiency. Like I just pointed out, we resolve all cases for, on average, $355 per case. That's pretty amazing. I run a statewide organization. Okay, we exist in just our St. Louis office. We handle not just St. Louis City, but conflicts in five surrounding counties. By contrast, there are 115 separate and distinct prosecutors' offices throughout this state. For her to suggest that we need to be more efficient is pretty surprising.
She's also fairly dismissive of all this by saying she thinks that people have begun to believe the kinds of things that you're saying because it has been repeated so often that therefore people tend to believe it.
And I point to reports that show it's fact-based. The ABA report, the Department of Justice report, has her office been studied? Do they do timekeeping? I don't think so.
How much time typically does a public defender spend on a case, and how many cases at any given time does a defender carry?
Well, you know, it's tough to say because there's different caseloads. You know, a younger attorney may take a higher number of cases, somewhere between 150 to 200, but they're taking less serious cases, misdemeanors and low-level felonies, whereas a more senior attorney would do the higher-level felonies at a lower caseload. But I think it's safe to say, and I have said, that on average, our attorneys have anywhere between 100 and 250 cases at any one time.
What kind of a defense can an attorney give if he's carrying that many cases?
Well, I think your suggestion is the answer. You know, you come in Monday morning and you look at 200 cases on your desk, and where do you begin? The Western District just said that even for a plea bargain, at the very least to provide competent counsel, we need to investigate the case. That means challenge the police report, look at all evidence, interview witnesses. We don't have the resources to do that for each case.
Is there a constitutional issue here in terms of the defendant in these cases getting adequate representation?
Well, absolutely there is. It's a guaranteed right to competent counsel when your liberty is at stake of being taken away. It absolutely is a constitutional issue.
So where can this go? I mean, obviously there's a difference of opinion here, and you say you've got a problem, she says you don't. What can you do to, aside from going public, to make change?
Well, first of all, I'm not shy about my numbers and my dollars. I'm willing to get that out there. In fact, I'm happy to debate the issue with Ms. Joyce. I'm quite sure that one of the law schools will give us the space, and heck, we can even sell tickets, raise some money for backstoppers, let's let her challenge me in public. I got the data to back it up. I don't think she does. That's why I'm encouraging media outlets to sunshine both of us on our resources and let them do a side-by-side in the paper or on the news about who's more resourced.
Well, if you get that debate going, be sure to let us know.
We'll do.
We'd like to be a part of and certainly covered. One other thing that came up in our conversation the other day concerned this issue of redaction and the fact that certain elements in criminal cases are redacted from reports that you don't have access to as a defense attorney. I know there's been some concern on the part of the public defenders about that because they need that information to provide, they say, an adequate defense. What is your stance on that?
Well, this is just part of the problem. You know, her office has been very slow in providing discovery to our office. That obviously exacerbates our caseload problem. It takes more time to get the evidence we need to look at the case, to investigate the case. And this is just part and parcel with that. We're entitled to that information. And I know this is being litigated right now. And I'll respect the court system and just let the result come out that way.
You might like to hear what she had to say about that.
We have always produced the witnesses for the defense to interview in person. And I know the public defenders purport to have financial issues and a lack of resources. We use our own investigative resources to find these witnesses and victims, and some of them are pretty hard to track down, and produce them at the public defender's office for them to speak to. And if they want us to leave the room, we will leave the room. So we actually make sure, and it's our obligation as prosecutors, to make sure the defendant has all the information that they need.
Well, by her own admission, they want it so they control access. And that's what we're trying to deal with here, is if they just provide the information up front, you know, we're in the best position to put on defense for our clients. And without all the information, we're not able to do that.
Well, she says she has a front row seat to all of it, and it's her responsibility to see to it that the defendant has a fair trial.
Well, without adequate resources, we can't do what we need to do for our clients.
Sit back to the legislature next time for more money?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we get our resources from. We not only does the legislature control how many dollars we get, as well as the governor, but they also put limits on how much we can take in from other resources. So even if some benevolent person or entity dropped $1 million off on my doorstep, I couldn't use it because the legislature caps it, the number of dollars we can take it outside from outside sources at $150,000, and that's for statewide.
That's Michael Barrett, who heads the Missouri Public Defender System. At the end of the interview, Barrett said that because his system is so strapped that even as director, he's occasionally in the courtroom trying cases himself, something he says Jennifer Joyce does not do or have to do. Yet to be determined whether Barrett's office will appeal the Cole County Court decision on his ability to appoint private attorneys, including Governor Nixon, to represent indigent defendants. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.